theme music for Open Air this week, coming to you live from the KALW studios, from the Real Vocal String Quartet, one of the groups performing some 13 sets of music this Saturday from 2 to 10 p.m. as part of the 8th annual Switchboard Music Festival at the Brava Theater. We'll hear more from them this hour, as well as from Annie Phillips, who is co-director of the presenting organization, Switchboard Music. Director Greg McKellen will share details about 42nd Street Moon's production of Nick and Nora, a Dashiell Hammett-inspired musical that hasn't seen a full production since 1991. Husband and wife team Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller are in studio to tell about the two-person multi-puppet production of King Lear at the Emerald Tablet here in San Francisco. Plus, critic Janos Garabin will share his love and knowledge of film music. Stay with us. Live here in the KALW studios, the Real Vocal String Quartet, which consists of Irene Sazer, violinist Alyssa Rose, Matthias McIntyre, the newest member of the ensemble on viola, and Jessica Ivry on cello. We'll be hearing from them more, both in voice singing and in voice talking about the Real Vocal String Quartet. And we'll also be hearing next from Annie Phillips, who is a bass clarinetist based in Oakland, but is also co-director of Switchboard Music and helps curate their annual festival and heads up the monthly concert series Switchboard Presents. Annie teaches musical entrepreneurship at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and is operations director at Zoo Labs, a music residency program in Oakland. Annie, a pleasure to welcome you back to KALW.
Thanks for having me.
Switchboard Music Festival number 13, is it?
Number eight.
Wow, I'm getting ahead of myself.
Almost there.
I miscounted. So quite a lineup from 2 to 10 p.m. How did you get the idea, or who came up with the idea of doing all of this music on one massive day?
So Switchboard was founded in 2006 by Ryan Brown, Jeff Anderley, and John Russell when they were all studying at the conservatory. And they noticed that there were a lot of musicians around in San Francisco that played a lot of different kinds of music, and they were comfortable both in a traditional concert hall or playing at a bar in the Mission, like Amnesia. But there was nowhere to go to see all of that music in one place, or no recognizable home for that music. So they decided to do a marathon music festival, kind of in the model of Bang on a Can, if you're familiar with that group.
Sure.
So the first festival they put on in 2008 at the Dance Mission Theater. And in 2011, it expanded and we moved to the Brava Theater, where we're having the festival this Saturday. And last year, I came on as co-director. John Russell moved to London, so I replaced him. But not to worry, kept two bass clarinet player co-directors. So
nice.
Switchboard's unofficial instrument.
Very nice. Very nice. So festival running from 2 to 10 p.m. Who's your coffee sponsor?
Actually, we have a beer sponsor.
A beer sponsor, well, even better.
Yeah, that's the main draw, I think, actually. But
well, we have the Real Vocal String Quartet here in studio, as we heard to open things up. Let's hear some more music from them. Let me first introduce the ensemble. Irene Sazer is a composer, arranger, and singer, a founding member of the Turtle Island String Quartet. She also founded and directs the School of Strings and String Improvisation in Berkeley. And the short list of artists she has recorded and or performed with include Ali Akbar Khan, Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, Natalie Cole, Frank Sinatra, Happy 100 Frank, David Grisman, and Billy Joel. Violinist Alice Rose, also on violin, is a genre-hopping presence on the Bay Area's classical, bluegrass, and other stages. She was a member of the Grammy-nominated Quartet San Francisco from 2008 to 12, and studied at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, where she now teaches, also teaching at the San Francisco Friends School. Matthias McIntyre is the newest member of the quartet and is a performer, improviser, composer, and teacher in many different contexts and styles. In addition to playing viola with the Real Vocal String Quartet this season, he's a member of the Bay Area group Vocollective, an ensemble dedicated to the performance of chamber music that includes voice. He also performs with guitarist Justin Huchin as the violin-guitar duo Krika, hope I'm pronouncing all that right, known for their refreshing arrangements of jazz standards and original works. Finally, Jessica Ivry plays with avant-garde composer and singer Amy X. Newberg, who's been in a guest studio for Open Air in the past, and with the cello Chicks Tet. She's also toured with, among other groups, singer-songwriter Vienna Tang, love her voice, and the women's choir Kitka. She's featured on the Grammy-nominated album Blueprint of a Lady by jazz vocalist Nina Freelon. And she holds degrees from Skidmore College and the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Welcome to you all.
Thanks so much for having us here.
Well, Irene, can you tell us a little bit, with my back to you, about how this ensemble got to be?
The very beginning seeds of this ensemble was a group of pieces that I wrote when my kids were 3 and 5. I had been putting my creative life on the back burner for a few years, and I was desperate to write music. And I found Jess and wrote a bunch of things for violin and cello. So that was the very beginning. But we soon filled it out into a string quartet, and then everybody in the group started writing, and we share these interests of as wide an array of music as we can find or imagine, and we share the love of singing and improvising.
Matthias, did you find them or vice versa?
I met Alyssa on a gig down in LA playing with this Persian orchestra. We were playing these Persian instruments that had like just been invented a year before or something. It was called a delodel, and we actually shared the flight home and just got to talking about some of our shared interests, which, you know, we sort of like, oh, you compose, oh, you improvise, that's really neat. And then 5 months later or something, she sent me an email saying, would you be interested in trying out with this group? Do you play viola and do you sing? And I sort of just answered yes to all three.
Never say no to a gig. It's been my rule of thumb as a flutist, that's for sure. Alyssa, how about you? How long have you been involved with the group?
For most of the group's existence, so at least 9 years or something.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, you are also a founding member of the group?
Yeah, so as Irene said, we met through a mutual violist friend, and I then said, you know, I know another great violist who should join, Dina Maccabee, who was an original member, and then she brought in Alyssa. They met, I think, on a bluegrass gig, right? Who knows? and so, yeah, so also an original founding member with Irene.
Nice. So you are part of the lineup for the Switchboard Music Festival. You're going to be performing at 8:10 or so at the Brava Theater this Saturday. Would you like to play something that you're going to do then, or would you like to do different work? What would you like to do first?
We're going to play a piece that I wrote, which we will also perform at Switchboard.
Music by the Real Vocal String Quartet. What's it called, Alyssa?
This is called Slacker Ridge.
Nice. Slacker Ridge.
It's written by Alyssa.
By Alyssa Rose. Mm-hmm. Performed by Alyssa and the rest of the Real Vocal String Quartet live in studio here at KLW. And then more with Annie Phillips. Where the band is meet the sky.
tastes like a ridge. Together and lonely as fog creeps round the bridge. Think of another as mist goes by, where the bed hills meet the sky.
Original work by Alyssa Rose and the Real Vocal String Quartet, performing live here in Studio A at KALW. Real Vocal String Quartet performing as part of the Switchboard Music Festival this Saturday at the Brava Theater. Annie Phillips, the co-director of the festival and of Switchboard Music, presenting this wonderful day-long event from 2 to 10 p.m. at the Brava. Hi again, Annie.
Hello.
We are so lucky to have these folks involved, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm so excited to hear them play. It's going to be great.
And one of the other big things that's happening is a tribute to Terry Riley, I understand, as part of this.
Yes, it is. So this season is the 50th anniversary of Terry Riley's In C, which is, you know, one of the first or the first major work of minimalism. And In C is something that we had always considered performing on Switchboard, just because, you know, the piece has a very all-inclusive nature. The way it's written makes it so that musicians of many ability levels can perform it. But as we were tossing around this idea, we realized that it would have been one of the oldest things ever performed on a Switchboard event. So we came up with this idea to do an homage to the original In C and invite 51 composers from our community to each contribute one cell. So the way In C works is it's 53 cells or snippets of music. Everyone starts together, repeats the first cell over and over, and then when they feel it's time to move on to the second cell, they move on to the second cell. So everyone moves through the work at their own pace and generally stays in the same area. So we got 51 people, Alyssa included. I wrote one. Jeff and Ryan both wrote one. Glenn Cochi from Wilco wrote one. Greg Sonier wrote one. All kinds of people wrote them. And so the headlining set of Switchboard is going to be most of the people performing on the festival are going to stay, and a couple people from past festivals are going to join us on stage, and we're going to perform it.
Nice. So that's the concluding work of the Switchboard Music Festival. Lots of people involved in C Ray Do, a tribute to Terry Riley's In C. Starting things off at 2 will be Brass Magic, an 8-piece ensemble that features quite a horn section performing original tunes influenced by the garbage of Manhattan, the F train, and strong beverages, apparently.
Yep.
That should be.
They're going to be a good way to kick it off, I think.
I think so. All kinds of great stuff, including Kitka. We heard the Real Vocal String Quartet, the San Francisco Conservatory Clarinet Ensemble performing mid-afternoon. You can find out all of the lineup and information as well as tickets at switchboardmusic.com. Quite a day coming up on Saturday at the Brava Theater. Thanks for sharing some details about it, Annie, and I hope people do check out the website and make an effort to catch, if not an hour, 6 or 8 hours of music on Saturday at the Brava.
Yeah.
Can I talk the quartet into playing maybe one more little tune to take us out?
And by the way, we are so excited about the festival Saturday night. We love Switchboard.
Yay.
Oh, it's Saturday day. That's our time, right? We love Switchboard. We're very excited.
What are you going to play for us?
This is a tune which is a combination of a tune from Kyrgyzstan and a fiddle tune I wrote based on the Kyrgyzstan tune.
And we sing in Kyrgyz, so if anybody knows the language, please be forgiving.
And I hope it's FCC friendly, so we'll see.
Right? Oh, yeah. Right.
Studio A here at KLW, the live performance of the Real Vocal String Quartet. String Quartet performing this weekend as part of the Switchboard Music Festival. Information at switchboardmusic.com. Still to come, Janosch Garabin will be sharing some film music. We'll hear from a husband-wife duo putting on King Lear, just the two of them, along with 30 of their closest friends in the form of puppetry. And next, a musical revival. This is Open Air on KALW.
Whatever you want, whatever you do, as long as you're happy, then I'm happy too. My mission in life is making that sweet smile appear. It's simple, that dimple gets me right here. So do what you will. I say here's to you, if there's something you'd like to be. Darling, feel free, as long as you're happy, then I'm happy too.
I hear you so well, so I'll say it too. As long as you're happy, then I'm happy too. You want me at home, just say the word, that's where I'll be. Fetch slippers, raise nippers, yup, sounds like me. And when the day ends,
yes,
and man's work is through, if you want to take me, that's fine. Your pleasure's mine.
As long as you're happy, then I'm happy too.
That's Barry Bostwick and Joanna Gleason from the musical based on Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man and the Sleuths' Nick and Nora Charles. Well, not since its brief Broadway run in 1991 has this musical gem, Nick and Nora, seen a fully staged production with music by Charles Strauss of Annie and Bye Bye Birdie fame and a book by the great Arthur Lawrence. The good folks at 42nd Street Moon are remedying that injustice now through April 19th at the Eureka Theater, with Moon's artistic director Greg McKellen leading the way. During his 21 years as artistic director of 42nd Street Moon, Greg has helped shape each season and has directed more than 50 musicals, adapting scripts for many of them. And it's a pleasure to welcome back to our airwaves. Hi, Greg.
Hi, David. Good to be here.
So let's start with something of a mystery. Why, with a cast that included Barry Bostwick, Christine Baranski, Faith Prince, and a Tony nomination for Best Score to boot, did Nick and Nora close after 71 previews and only 9 performances?
You know, it's kind of interesting. Back then, the standard way a show
prepared for Broadway was it would go on an out-of-town tryout. And that was the pre-internet day, so you could kind of get your work done without anybody seeing, you know, what was going on and reporting it. Nick and Nora didn't do that. The producers decided to just play previews, a set of previews in New York. And
which were basically tryouts that would have normally been done out of town.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, people started going. The word they did a lot of changes during the previews. So the word kind of got out, oh, the show's in trouble, and it kind of sort of fed on itself. So I think that was one of the big problems. I think to some degree people went in with expectations of Myrna Loy and William Powell that maybe got confused in the show or didn't get realized as fully as they would have liked. It's one of those things where it's like Rashomon, you know? Everybody, because Lawrence has written about it, Charles, of course, Strauss is still alive. In fact, he's coming to see our production.
Oh, fantastic. Has, he's 86 or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Has, you know, written about it and talked about it. To me, Richard Maltby Jr., the lyricist, you know, they all, everybody, and then Faith Prince is actually a good friend of mine. So everybody has their version of what went on and what went wrong. And hopefully we're going to sort of take all of that and
make lemonade
push it away
out of it.
And exactly make lemonade out of the lemons.
Well, yeah. You're known something as a script doctor or maybe a production doctor. Was any extensive surgery needed for your version of Nick and Nora to bring it to a new light?
You know, it's interesting. Really, what happened is getting it away from no. It's just getting it away from that kind of, you know, they were working under such pressure back then and kind of taking the show away from what was going on back then and from all the various disagreements.
And, yeah,
exactly.
Sure, sure.
And so really it's just kind of unearthing and rediscovering what's always been there. The score is outstanding, and it did get an original cast CD, as you played a little bit of it so far. And people, when they heard the CD, they began to say, this is a great score. How could this have flopped? And so now, 20-some-odd years later, hopefully we'll have unearthed a hidden gem.
Well, it is a kind of a mystery why it hasn't been done by other production companies in full-scale production.
Well, that part's not a mystery. It was such an unhappy experience for the creators, you know, ultimately, that they didn't license it out to a licensing agency, and they just sort of let it sit. About 4 or 5 years ago, just before Arthur Lawrence died, a group in Melbourne asked if they could present a concert of the songs. And he told them, I don't even know if I still have the script, but he did. And he sent it to them, and they got the score. And they did an evening of the songs from Nick and Nora. That's the only other time it's been tried since then. Hmm. So when I began to think, gee, I'd like to do this, I went to Charles Strauss and his office. And through them, we began to put this together.
Right.
Again.
Well, with such a wonderful track record that you've had of reviving musicals, I'm sure he was very receptive to it.
Well, he, you know, it's interesting. I just got an email from him today saying he's so nervous about this. This was sort of like the sick child musical for him, you know, and he worked very hard. He and Richard Maltby worked so hard on this to get this interesting kind of score that honors the sense of the 30s, but has kind of a more contemporary flavor, or contemporary to 1991 flavor in it. And they did a great job. And Charles did a great job. There's a lot of underscoring. And so this was sort of like his magnum opus, but that it, you know, didn't work out. It was very painful for him. So he's very nervous about it. But he's, he had a good, we brought him out for his 80th birthday for a celebration a few years ago. And he had such a great time with that. So I think that's why he's sort of trusting us.
Nice,
with it.
Nice. Well, I don't think you can go wrong reviving a Dashiell Hammett story in this town. That's
exactly.
Sure.
And what's interesting about the book, or rather the book of the musical, is that it actually goes back and takes some stuff from the original book some elements of Nick and Nora's relationship that weren't in the movie. And it's kind of interesting. It's a new story for the musical that they created, but it draws elements from the book, from the movie The Thin Man, and from some of the later Thin Man movies. There's a character who's very much same as a character in Song of the Thin Man, and there's a setting for one of the numbers, a kind of a tiki bar that's from another of the movies. So they kind of created this sort of mulligan stew of, you know, all sorts of elements of the Thin Man from the various sources. But through it all, the main relationship, of course, is Nick and Nora. And that's the same Nick and Nora that people have loved from the beginning.
Nice. Well, tell us about your choices for Nick and Nora for this production.
I'm very lucky. We have Ryan Drummond and Brittany Danielle playing Nick and Nora. Ryan works, both of them work all the time throughout the Bay Area. Brittany, in fact, goes right out of our production into Anything Goes out at Center Rep. Ryan has done several shows for us, including DuBarry Was a Lady and Painting the Clouds with Sunshine, and he was our leading man in Carnival. And what's fun is that they actually have known each other for a long time. They've done several shows together going back a few years. So they actually have chemistry as friends going into it. And since chemistry is one of the things that's so important for Nick and Nora, it's really terrific that I managed to get a Nick and a Nora who actually have that and have a history with each other as friends.
Nice. Well, the productions I've seen at Moon have had reduced pit ensembles, probably more due to space than anything else. What accompaniment is in store for us for this show, courtesy of the very talented Dave Dabrowski?
Dave is amazing. We have piano and woodwinds. The woodwinds are particularly important in the show, particularly a lot of saxophone, as you can guess, maybe with sort of a little bit of a film noir feeling some places. So we have the woodwinds and the piano. So it sounds really terrific.
And what other lost gems are in your proverbial 42nd Street Moon trunk that we might look forward to?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'll give you a scoop. Our opening show next season is going to be Sail Away.
Fantastic.
Which is a lost Noel Coward musical.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Broadway in 1961, London in 1962.
Elaine Stritch,
exactly. And she did it again in concert about 16 years ago in New York. And since then, there have been a couple of concerts, but there hasn't actually been a full production since the original. So that's what we're opening our season with.
We will definitely have you on to talk about that. That's Greg McKellen, artistic director of 42nd Street Moon and director of Nick and Nora, which you can catch through the 19th at the Eureka Theater on Jackson Street. Information at 42nd Street Moon, 42ndstreetmoon.org. Greg, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Dave.
We're going to hear more of the music of Charles Strauss, lyrics of Richard Maltby, part of the book of Arthur Lawrence, and again from the original production, Barry Bostwick and Joanna Gleason. Wishing you a swell production as well.
Thank you.
I feel swell. What a surprise, I feel swell. I'm taking charge, can't you tell? And I'm gonna come through. No one believes, not even you, but I will. Frankly, it's hard to sit still. I thought at first I'd feel lost, scared and helpless, but well, 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 I feel swell. I've been Mrs. Charles for a rather long time, sitting home mixing drinks while my Nick solves a crime. But this case puts me in the thick. How do I feel? I feel a kick. I feel good. And you know something, I should. I think I wanted to prove all my life I could ring that bell. I feel swell.
Just look at this place, God, I used to love dives like this. Who would suppose this is something that I would miss? I come here to question some guy. Once you're married, kiss that goodbye. This is swell, just like the old days, it's swell.
Get worked over by Nick Charles, I love the routines.
I buy the
the drinks. I spill the beans, this is great. Tell you the truth, I can't wait.
Cider, it's not my case.
Only one problem, I don't got no info that I can sell. Still, it's swell.
Yes, sir. Wait till he hears what I've done.
Wait till I tell her what's funny,
how things turn out swell. Just when everything's great.
You meet her, you spill it.
Learn more than you should. That's when I
a swell musical indeed happening at 42nd Street Moon, courtesy of Greg McKellen and a fine cast. Nick and Nora, the revival at 42nd Street Moon. Well, the Bay Area will see a number of King Lears this year. California Shakespeare Theater will be producing the show in the fall. But there's an unusual and unique interpretation of Shakespeare's tragic tale of family, king, and country about to open at the Emerald Tablet on Fresno Street here in San Francisco. King Lear and the Fool are the only characters played by humans. The company's two members, Conrad Bishop, who designed and built the puppets, and Elizabeth Fuller, who wrote the show's score, are also husband and wife. The rest of the cast is operated by these same humans, with some 30 or so puppets being manipulated, ranging in size from finger puppets to life-sized ones. It's such a pleasure to welcome Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller in studio to talk about this production. After training at Northwestern and Stanford and 5 years of university teaching, they were co-founders of Milwaukee's Theater X, which went on to achieve international recognition for four decades. Back in 1974, they formed The Independent Eye, touring throughout the U.S. with original work ranging from grim realism to story theater to Shakespearean puppetry, and have done masterclasses and residences at hundreds of colleges and theaters around the country. Conrad, Elizabeth, welcome to Open Air.
Oh, it's really good to be here.
Yeah, man, that makes me tired already.
I'm exhausted. I don't know how you guys do it. We'll talk about getting through a show like this as well. Well, like when I've had clowns on the radio, people have a certain immediate brain-stamped preconception when you mention the word puppet,
oh,
don't
sure,
they?
Oh, sure, sure. But I think that's changing a lot. I mean, because there's a lot more adult puppetry. I think probably ours is a little unique because we are so word-heavy and word-conscious. I mean, text is really, really important to us. But the lovely thing about the puppets is that you can use a broader physicality than you can in a conventional Shakespeare production.
Mm-hmm. It's really unusual to look when we have turned the lights off and stepped outside the set, which is very, very small. This can be performed in a living room, and in fact, it will be in L.A. on our way back from the San Diego Puppetry Festival. But your mind makes it expand, and you look and you say, is that all there was? Because it took you right into the world.
Hmm, interesting. Now, this is epic Shakespeare we're talking about here. So in this version, we shouldn't be looking for a faithful to the first folio edition of the Bard's words.
Well, actually, you are. Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
It's just been abridged for length.
Productions are always abridged because otherwise it would be, you know, 3 or 4 hours. But we abridge a little bit more than the norm, simply because of the medium. But all of those favorite old quotes will be in there, hopefully with a fresh tang on them.
Mm-hmm. And we give a kind of a Cliff Notes way to jump from scene to scene through contemporary little bridges that the Fool speaks, which is me. Of course, it's in a voice like this. I don't know if I'm going to blow the microphone away.
She's a very nasty insult comic.
I'm a fire plug insult comic.
That's great. Now, Conrad, you designed and created the puppets. Were these unique for this particular production?
Oh, yeah.
And so I mentioned that they're from finger size to life size.
In a sense, they're very realistic. But Shakespeare goes both ways. He's a realist. He also jumps into metaphor to the extreme. And so, you know, during the battle is basically a long string of paper dolls that are ripped to pieces by a very angry fool. The puppets themselves are, I start with a clay model and work on that until it works right, and then cast it in papier-mâché. and which is very sturdy. And the great thing is that it's very lightweight. If you're a puppeteer with puppets on your hands with your arms out there for 100 minutes, you really value those fewer ounces.
But one thing that audiences can expect with this is an unusual degree of scenic, high-octane experience, because you, for one thing, you get to be quite close. In any of these venues that we're performing in, you get to be quite close. And we've spent a lot of time dyeing fabrics and making things work together visually. Plus, in between every scene, when the fool is doing this bridge stuff and we're moving puppets around to get ready for the next one, Conrad has produced some absolutely trippy, surreal video projection, not to be able to make out things that you're seeing, but to put you in a different universe.
Wow.
You fall out of the reality and into the surreal between every one of these things.
Yeah, in a way, I think it's any kind of puppetry is kind of like a dream, and especially when you're hearing a very concentrated text like this that is going to very, very dark places. It's not taking a clear narrated trip. It's going into another kind of consciousness, I think.
So at any one point in a scene of King Lear, how many characters are you performing?
I may be voicing, at one point, I'm voicing four characters and the live King Lear. And maybe Elizabeth is voicing one as the fool, but I may be manipulating it, I may be voicing it, and she's manipulating it, because we only have two hands.
We're old radio hands here, and so making clear vocal distinctions is part of the artist's palette.
Nice, nice.
And part of our problem. I mean,
I was going to say
it's still in process of no, it doesn't quite work there. Yeah.
Right. Well, I got to ask, how do you, if you're the only human actors that are manipulating all of these puppets, how do you keep track of them all?
Well, that's an interesting question. No, I built the stage and I invented this rack system that we use. All of the puppets are always there in the audience's view, waiting to come on off stage. You know these things that you screw to the wall and you stick your broom handle in there and mm-hmm. it holds it up? Well, these are larger ones than that, but the puppets...
They're actually built for puppet necks. They're not built for
broom
handles.
But at either side of the stage, they're all lined up there waiting for us. You can see them the entire time. They only go away from there when they die. And, of course, so by the time we're done at the end, there's an awful lot of puppets on the floor.
A lot of blood. A lot of puppet blood.
Yeah.
Well, so it answers my question in that way, in that you don't have a team of people behind the stage trying not to see the puppets and, here's your Goneril or here's your Cordelia. No, go.
It's
all up to you guys to track all that.
And the tech is done in full view for the audience as well. The lights, the sound, and the video are all run from a laptop that the fool has in front of him during the whole thing. You can see it, right? That's how that happens.
But part of that sense, I think, to start with when we were first starting it, is the idea that Lear is really creating his own puppet show, as any person with absolute power thinks they are doing.
Interesting.
And the process of discovering that his puppets aren't entirely cooperating with him and are, in fact, stripping him of everything that he values or everything that he is or everything that he thinks he is.
That's a fascinating tie into the whole situation with the tragedy.
Yeah,
And with us, with our contemporary people we know who are in positions of enormous power, we have now the megaphone of the media that makes it possible to amplify that intensely. I mean, Vladimir Putin kind of turned himself into a puppet by taking off his shirt and featuring himself riding on a bear and all that kind of thing. And then that's what he becomes in people's eyes. And eventually, who knows, it may be what he becomes in his own eyes.
Very fascinating. So you've tackled other Shakespeare in this way?
We had from about 1978 to 1995,
Do you allow the use of the Scottish plays titled? People get very freaky about that.
I've had worse things said on the air.
We did Macbeth for about 15 years in touring repertory, and that was with three actors as the witches and three dozen masks and puppets. And a lot of people said it was the most frightening Macbeth they'd ever seen. And then more recently, we did a totally different kind of thing, two productions of his most to me, most beautiful, most moving plays, The Tempest and The Winter's Tale. And this is certainly at an entirely different direction from those. And also the puppetry varies according to the story. But it seems to work really well with our conception of the way Shakespeare wants to be played. Mm-hmm. It's very, very text-centered, and yet it expands that into gesture, into metaphor, into visual language that you can get on the stage maybe if you have a $3 billion budget, but not otherwise.
Yeah, this is an extremely physical and visual production.
So with this production of Lear, you mentioned that it's going to be here in San Francisco through the end of the month, and then you're going to take it on the road. Is that what you typically do with a production? You hold on to it for a while?
That's what we've always wanted to do. Over the course of the last 45 years, we've periodically gotten stuck into wonderful spaces where suddenly we were running a regular season in the way that people do, and that's a wonderful thing. But for our work, the idea of really maturing it the way we would raise a child has always been very important.
We recently committed ourselves to a vow that in terms of making new productions, if it won't fit in the Prius, we won't do it. And we were not sure if we could get all of King Lear into the Prius and still have space to sleep in it because we're cheapskates and we don't want to pay motels.
Well,
we sleep in truck stops.
Collaboration with the clown. You got to get a clown car.
Yeah, right, that'll, right. Well, yes, we have a clown car, and we have already done the trial packing of Lear, and it goes.
That's Elizabeth Fuller and her husband, Conrad Bishop, a husband-wife team who are presenting King Lear in full puppetry splendor along with their own actual human being acting skills. Elizabeth, you also composed original music for this production. Has that been your...
Yeah, I have been, in effect, the movie composer for everything that we've done in our whole long... We've been working together and living together for 54 years. And I have written over 30 scores. But
60, 70.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. My gosh.
You just forgot them. did them all late at night.
Conrad gave me he put me on the super-duper-looper roller coaster with this one. He said, I want you to do a score that contains nothing but voice. And I thought, you are out of your mind. But I had already listened probably 100 times to Meredith Monk's Mercy. And I had a sense of what can be done with voices. She uses other things in that. But somebody gave me a gift last summer of a TC Helicon real-time digital voice processor. And so I have composed the entirety of this score with nothing other than my voice and my friendly little black box.
Very nice. Well, I look forward to hearing it. I really encourage people to see this incredible production. I'm absolutely fascinated by it. I wish you a splendid run at the Emerald Tablet, 80 Fresno Street here in San Francisco. Starting on April 10th, you open through the 26th of this month with a matinee close. Information at independenteye.org.
That's EYE, not letter I.
Independenteye.org.
And for those who don't know where Fresno Street is, it's next to our other favorite place in the whole world, which is Cafe Trieste in North Beach.
Oh, there you go.
It's a half block away.
Great location. Have a great production.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
With that introduction, I am pleased to welcome back to the microphone Janosch Garabin to talk about some film music, appropriately the 20th Century Fox theme. Welcome back.
Thank you. And I'm going to cut it short about the long, long list of what I like.
Well, let's do a second segment some other time.
Okay. So out of the Hollywood greats of Korngold, Steiner, and Waxman, I would like to show just a little snippet from a Waxman score that is little known today. It's Hemingway's Adventures of a Young Man.
Music of Waxman. Here we go.
Thank you.
Wow, that's some great stuff. Franz Waxman's music.
And this is, again, from his film, which is pretty much unknown at this point. So,
well, as a piccolo player, I'm loving it.
to jump, I don't know, 6-7 decades from the Hollywood greats, and even jumping over such excellent recent scores as Philip Glass's soundtrack for Mishima, we come to Tan Dun's Chinese New Agey film scores, which you will be able to hear with the movies in Davis Hall. This is a film and concert combination in the Symphonies film series. It's three scores by Tan Dun for Zhang Yimou's Hero, which is probably my favorite film, Fang Xiaogang's The Banquet, which is a variation on Hamlet and Ibsen's Ghosts with Zhang Ziyi, and Ang Lee's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. This will be, it's called Tan Dun's Martial Arts Trilogy, screening with live accompaniment by the symphony on Saturday, April 25th in Davis Hall. sfsymphony.org has the information about tickets. And also an hour before the event in the Davis Hall lobby, Melody of China will perform live. And here is perhaps the opening of the soundtrack for Hero with Itzhak Perlman and a variety of Chinese instruments.
Of Tan Dun, which you can hear live here in the San Francisco Davies Hall, San Francisco Symphony performing with the film in the background.
And just a quick reference to another Chinese Western composer, Bright Shang, whose commissioned opera, Dream of the Red Chamber, is on the San Francisco Opera schedule for fall 2016. What makes this a timely topic is that there are two film festivals coming up in April and May, both with vital music components. The 20th season of the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, with live accompaniment for all screenings, will be held in the Castro Theater May 28 through June 1. Web address is silentfilm.org, and I'd like to come back to this next month.
Sure.
The other one is the 58th season of the San Francisco International Film Festival, which is running April 23 through May 7. Announced this week, web address is sffs.org, the San Francisco Film Film Society. Very quickly, the World Cinema Spotlight is all about music this year, including documentaries about Nina Simone, the Beach Boys, and San Francisco's The Residents. And then the Kronos Quartet appears live to play Alexandra Vrabelov's score for Bill Morrison's film about World War I. It's called Beyond Zero, 1914-1918. The screening will take place with the Kronos playing live at the Sundance Kabuki Cinemas at 6:30 p.m. on May 6.
Janosch Garabin, thank you for that wonderful film reference mini tour. We'll have you on again soon to maybe talk about the film festival next month and some more wonderful music. Ending with some music by a very well-known actor, but also a composer.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
Can you name that composer?
Smile, even though I don't hear
it. Oh, it's a quiz. Oh, here we go.
When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you
so now that you can hear it, do you know who wrote it?
No.
Charlie Chaplin.
Oops.
And that opening theme that we had as part of our introduction segment, the 20th century music theme, 20th century Fox theme, was written by Alfred Newman.
Mm-hmm.
Later inspired John Williams to include it as a segue right into his Star Wars theme. So we got lots to talk about with film. We'll have you on again to talk more. You've been listening to Open Air. I'm David LaTulip with you every Thursday afternoon at 1. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for manipulating the herds that come in and out of this wonderful studio for your edification, and all of the wonderful people associated with the performing arts who take the time to come up to KALW Studios. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org.
Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile. That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.